Hello and welcome back to the Critic Podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and with me today is Fred Sculthorpe, an excellent writer who's written an excellent piece for our latest print edition. It's titled The Keyboard Secret Army, and it addresses what might be called the disinformation industry, not just the industry which produces real or alleged disinformation, but the industry which covers it. Fred, how are you today?
I'm very good. Thank you. One of the first things I ever wrote for The Critic was about how much I hated podcasts. And I found myself on one, and I hate them because there's a high propensity to talk bollocks unchallenged for half an hour. And I'm sure it's an argument listeners will be sympathetic towards by the end of this podcast.
Well, I'm going to try and be just as sensitive to challenging any kind of bollocks as my podcasting heroes like Joe Rogan or Alex Jones. But speaking seriously, of course, your piece addresses the phenomenon of disinformation reporters, people who kind of explicitly devote themselves to challenging and dissecting and ridding the public sphere of real or alleged disinformation, real or alleged bollocks. Where do you think this phenomenon came from? Because even the word disinformation, the popularity feels quite new. So where did these reporters emerge from?
Well, I mean, it's a long story. I mean, disinformation is a word that comes from, it was used by the Soviets in the 1920s, and it was a very deliberate attempt to spread deliberately wrong information, usually with the aim of achieving some sort of political end. Where does the disinformation reporter come from? Well, I mean, the whole story, it starts with the advent of social media in the early 2010s, essentially. And a very good writer called Martin Gurry has written about this huge transition in the way we consume news media, essentially. He calls it the fifth wave. And Martin is, he was a CIA analyst, basically. His job was more or less to track media all around the world. And, you know, in his book, he says in the 80s and 90s, it was a very easy job. You know, you just had newspapers and television channels and all this stuff. And suddenly, you know, with the rise of social media, that job has changed completely. All of a sudden, you have huge amounts of what he calls decentralized media. You know, everything from sort of startup news outlets to people with a large Facebook or Twitter following. And it becomes very chaotic. Now, at the start, it's important to point out that initially, this sort of rise of social media is really quite exciting. We see things like the Arab Spring, and there's a real sense that, you know, if we can bring people together, like-minded people, we can reassert democracy and human rights, all this sort of thing. And it's a really quite exciting time. And, you know, the Arab Spring has very positive coverage. And the role of Facebook in organizing these protests is really focused on by lots of journalists all over the world. As we now know, as the decade progresses, this idea sort of loses favor. We get Brexit and then we get Trump. And suddenly this excitement of the online space and its potential to do good in the world is completely changed. And suddenly we're talking not about its potential, but the need to sort of tame it, essentially. Where does the specific title disinformation reporter come from? Well, there's a journalist called Davy Alba. And she writes a piece on the Philippines and how Duterte came to power in that country using Facebook. And it's a good piece. It's, you know, she does her stuff. And in particular, she combines the context of the country and things like what was going on at the time with this rise of disinformation, misinformation on social media. Now, Alba's story is really significant. I would argue it's very influential in people like Mariana Spring, who I've written about. This idea that what happens online has a real tangible impact in the real world. Now, fine, okay, in the Philippines, Alba's analysis holds up for all sorts of different reasons. The lack of a sort of very established media, the presence of things like drug wars, and Duterte really does exploit that quite effectively. Now, fast forward a little bit, and 2019, we get Carol Cadwalader, who's in the news at the moment, obviously, because she's just lost her case to Aaron Banks. And she gives a TED talk. And she's just won the Orwell Prize, essentially, for pointing out that her belief that the reason why things like Brexit and Trump happened was that essentially people were manipulated online and they were fed sort of dodgy information and this made them vote in a certain way. And the 2019 TED Talk is a really important event in the disinformation world, as sad as that sounds. Cadwalader really goes to town on this idea that not only is bad information online causing people to lose elections, it's also a threat to democracy itself. And there's this idea that any powerful political campaign with enough money and influence can use things like Facebook and Twitter to target individual people in specific seats and get them to vote in a certain way. And she speaks very movingly about how this quiet town in a Welsh valley where she grew up suddenly overnight became racist and against immigrants and all this stuff. And it's a very convenient argument for the liberal left. They can basically say that, you know, none of the causes of Brexit or Trump have anything to do with these long-term discontents of global neoliberalism. It's all about what's happening online and algorithms and all this stuff. And I think that's part of the reason why Cadwalader's story becomes so powerful. Now, where do we get the disinformation reporter from? I would argue it's this atmosphere of paranoia, this fear of the online space, this fear that what people are reading online has the potential to have really dangerous consequences in the real world. And in 2020, on the eve of lockdown, we get the BBC's first disinformation reporter, Mariana Spring. And, you know, the rest is history, basically.
I remember in the 90s and the noughties, there was a view on the left that the kind of views we might now call kind of the populist right, you know, very skeptical of the EU, quite opposed to immigration, was to a very large extent a product of the tabloid media. It was, you know, the Daily Mail lies, the Sun lies, the News of the World lies. And looking back, I can see a kind of link between these two phenomena, this sense that people don't really have any substantive complaint with the status quo. They're just singularly being manipulated by these powerful forces, be they Rupert Murdoch sitting James Bond villain-like in his office, or Piers Corbyn ranting in the street with some imagined pot of Kremlin money lurking behind him. Do you think it's fair to say that this, or maybe the scale of this concern about disinformation, is an attempt to avoid what might be called material problems or structural problems?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, you know, this is a long-standing criticism, I think, of left-wing thought, particularly in responding to things like Brexit and Trump. It's this idea that people have been manipulated by nefarious powers and, you know, the Koch brothers and all this stuff. And I might add this sort of very lazy thinking that, you know, anyone who reads the Daily Mail or any of these outlets has somehow been lied to or lacks agency to think about the world around them and the material changes. And I think some of the most powerful criticisms of that idea have actually come from liberals on the left, particularly guys like George Packer, who's written really, you know, sweeping books about essentially how the sort of revolt of the public in Trump and Brexit has been in the long running for a long time, you know, since the 80s, even the US as far back as the 60s. And I think, you know, if we want to seriously understand why people are supposedly falling for lies and all this stuff, I think focusing purely on the newspapers they read or the things they see online is not only disingenuous, but a very poor way of winning these people back, if that's what you intend to do.
You say in your piece about the kind of disproportionate focus on fairly uninfluential voices. I think it's in that piece that you write about a reporter going after just this random guy spreading online disinformation to hilariously few followers. And it's almost a kind of confusion of the anthropological, this kind of Louis Theroux-ian poking at fairly random eccentrics, and then the political. Do you think there's maybe a confusion of politics and a kind of entertainment here?
I'd say very much so. In fact, this is one of the main criticisms I have. And to be fair, I'm not the first one to make it. It's this idea that disinformation reporting is very much punching down, and it's sort of trying to debunk the narratives and the paranoia of the powerless. And I think a recent piece in The Critic, I think, sort of answers this. I think there's a curious lack of attempts to understand why these people are believing these things, and why people online are sharing these conspiracy theories. And it sort of overlooks the fact that there is a huge crisis of trust in media and government, particularly after the pandemic. And the issue I highlight in particular is transparency. A lot of the reasons why we have these vaccine conspiracies is that people like Matt Asim, Malhotra, and Andrew Grisham really cotton on to the fact that a lot of these vaccine development companies, you know, the availability of data and protocol of how these studies are run was very untransparent. There was a huge issue of transparency. And this is not to say that Grisham and Malhotra are right. They're completely wrong. There's plenty of evidence which suggests that a lot of their claims are nonsense. But the kernel of these conspiracy theories starts with a lack of transparency. And it's this sort of curious refusal to engage with this idea that really irritates me about disinformation reporting. And I think I got into an argument with Mike Wendling, the former editor of the BBC Disinformation Unit. And his basic argument is that, you know, actually these people do have a huge amount of influence. You know, if a Twitter account with 100,000 followers is sharing misinformation or disinformation, you know, this has really dangerous impacts in the real world. I think that's highly debatable. I really do. In fact, there's a really interesting study just put out by, I'm going to look this up. I believe it's the Kennedy Harvard Kennedy School, and they've got this whole unit dedicated to misinformation. And they've done this very clever study where they try to sort of determine reliability and accuracy of news. And they basically argue that small increases in acceptance of reliable information, even by margins as small as 1%, has a far bigger impact than attempts to reduce the prevalence of misinformation. So to translate this into sort of, you know, everyday stuff, you know, if we can increase trust in things like the BBC and Sky and these traditional outlets, which are supposed to have some sense of central ground and trust and impartiality, it's massively, massively more influential in restoring public trust in information than hiring disinformation reporters to scour through the depths of the internet and find all this nonsense. And of course it's a problem. Yeah, you know, you can log on to Twitter and find all sorts of nonsense stuff. But really, I think what it gets down to is what is the role of a journalist now? Is it just to sort of debunk other narratives, or is it actually to go out and try and find the truth yourself? And I think the COVID lab leak story is really interesting in this respect. Really significant example of how disinformation reporting fails. Just to recap the story, at the start of the pandemic, you know, there was all sorts of rumors about where this virus had come. And very prematurely, all the sensibles in the media, and particularly in the US, ruled out the idea that the virus could have come from a lab. And famously, Facebook fact-checked an unheard story, which basically said we shouldn't rule out this idea. You know, even very respected columnists and thinkers like Matt Ridley were really delving into this idea and really making quite a convincing case that we shouldn't rule this out. But of course, many of these outlets were saying, no, this is all nonsense. It's being lies being spread by right-wing conspiracy theorists and all this stuff. And of course, we've now seen that, I think it's the US Energy Department has put out reports saying it's very likely that the virus came from a lab. So this is the problem with disinformation reporting. If you set yourself up to be some sort of arbiter of truth, it really does come back to bite you if you get the story wrong.
Yeah, I think it was Mehdi Hassan on Twitter this week. He released some kind of tweet which said, actually, you should blame the conspiracy theorists for lab leaks not being taken seriously, because it was kind of jumbled up with these other false claims about the virus, but that just makes a nonsense of the whole, in air quotes, field, because if a disinformation reporter isn't good at separating the disinformation from the valid information and instead just sees it as this broad category of nonsense, I mean, what kind of insight are they actually providing? They're not any kind of, they don't have the quality of a surgeon. They just have the quality of a street sweeper, and not even one who's clever enough to pick out the £5 note that's buried under the crisp packets. it's a sad state of affairs. But you talked about how improving trust in the media is more effective than kind of the media going out there to try and remove elements that question the level to which it should be trusted. So how can we improve that trust? What could be some practical steps to increase transparency and to increase the level of quality in the media? Obviously, I can't expect, you know, a PhD thesis on from it, but what are some suggestions you might make to the likes of Spring or an Aronovich?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, really, isn't it? This crisis of media, trust in media, has been going on for a long while. What I find really interesting is that around the pandemic, the start of the pandemic, if you look at these graphs put out by all these research companies, you see a decline in trust, which has been going on for a while across the decade. It actually starts to plateau at the start of the pandemic. So this terrifying event comes along, and actually people sort of flock back to things like the BBC and Sky looking for reassurance. And that's a real noticeable effect on these charts. And then gradually, as the pandemic goes on, once more, the trust starts to decline again, in fact, even faster, particularly with Sky News. I don't particularly know why that is the case, but it really is an outlier in that respect. Again, I've said we should abolish the disinformation reporter, and that sounds like some sort of silly, reactionary, attention-seeking headline. But I really do believe this is the case, not least all the problems that have been thrown up by this paradigm of trying to look at information. As you said, there are numerous instances, particularly in the pandemic, where supposed disinformation experts ended up labeling perfectly valid information as wrong. The worst example of this took part in Whitehall, where, you know, at the height of the pandemic, there were civil servants running around circulating dossiers, some of which even included the views of people who would later become advisors to the government, people like Carl Hennigan, who met with Rishi Sunak, I think, just before the second lockdown. And, you know, we get this ridiculous situation where Sunak, having previously been briefed against Hennigan, is now receiving advice from him. So it's a totally failed paradigm, and it particularly gets exposed during complicated events like the pandemic, where suddenly you have the inaction of unprecedented policies like lockdown, the development of new vaccines, all this sorts of thing, and all over the world, you get lots of different studies coming out which claim various different things. And I feel sorry for any BBC hack sitting at the news desk having to write this stuff up, because it really did get confusing. And I would argue that they were let down. You know, particularly Mike Wendling, I think, did a really awful job during the pandemic with his team. He really let down. The moment you start slapping fact check on top of an article, you really set yourself up for danger. And the article I talk about in the piece in particular involved a notorious incident in which Sajid Javid, the then health secretary, paid a visit to the hospital. And a doctor, an NHS doctor, challenged him over the vaccine mandate for healthcare staff. The gist of his argument was that he had already had COVID numerous times. He developed very effective antibodies. Having antibodies and also having the vaccine, there were studies which suggest that improved your protection. But when discussing a policy like a vaccine mandate, which is highly controversial and is essentially almost coercing people to take a medical treatment that they may otherwise not want to, and it is controversial, to really delve into the story with claims that you'd fact check the doctor and all this stuff, I think is highly irresponsible, and exactly the sort of thing that leads to the decline in trust, decline in this idea that the BBC is there to be the arbiter of truth, the arbiter of information on particularly complicated stories. And I think Mike Wendling in particular, that I've raised this with him numerous times and he's never got back to me, I think because he probably regrets putting fact checks on this story. And there are numerous examples of this throughout the pandemic. You know, this was going on in Whitehall, Facebook, the Twitter moderators were shadow banning people like Jay Bhattacharya and all this stuff. So of course, this disinformation, misinformation paradigm is completely open to abuse, and we saw it during the pandemic.
Let me play devil's advocate. I mean, obviously, in the past, and I'm sure still today, there have been what we might call alternative theories or, you know, just plain nonsense, which has been very popular or even proved dangerous. I guess the most notorious dangerous example would be Protocols of the Elders of Zion. But then there are also less insidious, but still harmful theories that are put around, I don't know, let's say alternative medicine. You know, people are encouraged to do completely batty things for their health, like, you know, consuming toxic materials to rid their bodies of imaginary worms. This kind of nonsense, even if it's not as influential as disinformation reporters might have us believe, it has some kind of effect. And the question I want to put to you is, how do you think we could constructively challenge them? I was recently reading a debate between the blogger Scott Alexander and the podcaster Chris Kavanagh, where Alexander was basically taking the position that we should very thoroughly investigate and very kind of publicly dissect these opinions, firstly to find out whether they're right, and secondly to expose why they're wrong. And then Kavanagh was taking the position where I think it was more, we should just be trying to keep them out of the public eye. We should just be trying to exclude them. I think that's fair to say. He was pretty much just saying, keep them as far away from the limelight as possible, and then nobody has to worry about them. Where would you fall if you were somehow given the task of addressing some piece of disinformation, real or alleged? How would you go about addressing it?
Well, I would argue this has always been a feature of our media anyway. Journalists have always written stories about claims that are wrong, stories that people believe which aren't true. To me, this is ingrained into the very point of journalism. You're out there to tell a story, to find the truth. What would I do in attempts to tackle disinformation? For a start, I stop calling it disinformation. The word has lost all meaning. You log onto Twitter now and everyone is being accused of disinformation. You know, everyone from Gavin Barwell is throwing the word around to anyone who criticizes net zero energy policy. You know, it's just become a completely meaningless word. And I think there's a really good piece in Unheard about disinformation in the Donbass before the war. And I think the author of the piece, David Patrick Karakos, acknowledged that even there, the word had completely lost all meaning. Your answer is how to tackle bad information online. again, I would return to the results of the study. You need to accept that organizations like trusted organizations or organizations that should be trusted, like the BBC, need to do a better job with reporting. You know, I really think the standards of places like the BBC have fallen, sadly. And I write these pieces very much from someone not who's reactionary and wants to get rid of the BBC, but I'm very much a reformist. I'm in favor of gradually, hopefully restoring trust in these organizations. I really do think they're needed, particularly as mistrust is clearly growing and the world's becoming more complicated and more volatile. My boring sort of report recommendations to that, I can write a whole sort of white paper on how to restore trust in the BBC. There are simple things to do, like, you know, basic fact checking, not weighing into complicated stories, claiming you fact check someone, all these sorts of things. It's probably a rubbish answer. It's probably a disappointing answer. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're returning to the sort of what is a journalist in today's world? Are they there to go out and tell people where they've gone wrong? Or are they there to, you know, tell the truth? are they there to not only tackle bad information, but also challenge bad information from those in power as well? I think there was a lot of the former during the pandemic. There was a lot of pointing out what, you know, the mad people, the nutters, the Ike fans, and very much not so much of the latter, in which those in power were also capable of spreading information which wasn't quite so accurate, or enacting policies which weren't fully understood. And I think this is where this crisis of trust comes from. It's this perception of imbalance in the media. And Mariana Spring in particular, she's a favourite of the conspiracy theorists. Every time I write about her, I get all sorts of mad people replying to my articles who evidently haven't read them, because they would understand that I'm also very much against what they're doing. I just think that Spring's attempts to tackle it are inherently flawed.
Yeah, it's interesting how the term fact check has evolved. I mean, now when people are used to it, it seems to always be they've checked the facts and they're all wrong. Whereas as much as Snopes has become a bit of a meme now, at least when it began, you know, sometimes they would validate a strange idea on the internet, and then sometimes they would discredit it. Fact checking isn't just disproving something, it's analyzing something and then trying to come to a conclusion. And I think you make good points about the inadequate media criticism. We're coming up to the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, very famously, there was all kinds of bad information, what we might now call disinformation, being broadcast on the front pages of the newspapers, being spewed out in the UN by Colin Powell about, you know, Saddam's links with Al-Qaeda, how he had weapons that could be launched within 45 minutes towards Britain's. How much more actual media criticism do you think needs to be done?
I think, I really do think, I mean, you point out a much more perennial, deeper crisis of trust of media in the 21st century. And I do genuinely think it's one of the biggest problems of our time. You look at the US and news is completely partisan. The statistics are ridiculous. Democrats and Republicans are watching a completely different thing. They're living in different realities, more or less. Media criticism. One thing I found really fascinating was there was a debate in the US, a very prestigious media debate. I can't remember which one it is because I'm useless at remembering these things, but it was Malcolm Gladwell and someone else against Matt Taibbi and I think Douglas Murray. And and I think the motion was this house should not trust the mainstream media. Now, their audience were media students, I think. You know, they were very much sort of what I like to call the sensibles, people who read, you know, the New York Times and this stuff. And they're very much liberals in that respect. And I think they took a vote before the debate, and the debate was against the motion. People should trust mainstream media. And by the end, by the time Taibbi and Murray had their say, the House had completely changed their position and said that, no, you should not trust mainstream media, partly because Taibbi had laid out all these cases of times when the media deliberately misled people. The very famous case at the moment is, I think, the Columbia School of Journalism put out a huge piece on how badly the Trump-Russia story had been covered. Just very basic reporting mistakes, unverified sources, all this sort of thing. It's a huge problem. I mean, you can be cynical and catastrophic and say it can't be saved and it's irreparable and we should abolish all these organizations. I think that's a bit silly. I think we really have to believe that, you know, we can restore trust in returning to basic things, like believing that there are such things as truth and all this sort of thing. There's a real trend at the moment, I think, Martin Gurry calls post-journalism, in which newspapers and outlets survive not on the accuracy of their reporting, but the narrative in which they're pushing. Now, this sounds, you know, ridiculous, but it's things that are being very much written about positively by some very influential journalists. I can't remember his name, but this guy at Washington Post, he's been there for 30 years, and he was talking all about how I think his claim was that objective news is essentially a white male construct and all this stuff. So we're really veering into an era of, I think, post-journalism. And I think, you know, a simple solution is to not go down that route and really believe that journalists can still play a role in telling strong stories, powerful stories that people listen to.
A couple of days ago, you had a very polite, respectful, collegial exchange of views with the outgoing Times columnist David Aronovitz. I'm being slightly sarcastic. It was quite a ill-tempered exchange of points with the outgoing Times columnist David Aronovitz on Twitter about your piece. I don't want to focus too much on Mr. Aronovitz because we don't want to distract him while he's cooking up his thriller. But I did want to ask you, do you think it's possible that journalists and commentators, or at least many journalists and commentators, have an exaggerated sense of their kind of intellectual elevation above the average person?
Oh, it's a fascinating question. I mean, I won't comment, obviously, as you say, I won't comment too much on Aronovitz. You know, he has an exciting thriller to write. We don't want to distract him further. But look, we've spoken a lot about this crisis of trust in media, and to be critical of some of my own writing, it's something I rely upon a lot. So I go, oh, there's this crisis of trust in media, you know, we must do something. And people say, and you have said, what should we do? And I think, you know, a lot of media is marketing. Some of the stories are very much marketed. And I think Spring is an example of that. In fact, this is how I got onto writing about her, as I was speaking to a very experienced veteran BBC journalist. You know, he's 20, 30 years in the business, all sorts of investigations, very, very, you know, proper old school hack. And we were talking about the pandemic and how the BBC covered it. And, you know, he brought up the disinformation unit, who internally have a very poor reputation because of some of the bad ways they dealt with stories. And in particular, he focused on Spring, who he felt was very much all about profile rather than a sense of public duty, I might add, which comes of being a BBC journalist, in which, you know, you're expected to sort of work in the shadows, I think, and not become this big name. And I think, I'm sorry, I think Spring is very much guilty of that. She's curiously positioned herself in the organisation as a sort of go-to person whenever something bad happens in the world. And the analysis tends to be the sharing of online disinformation. And that sort of appears to be the end of it. You know, she'll go on the Today programme and they'll go, there's been a coup in Brazil. And she'll go, well, yes, people were sharing all these terrible things online. And there's no, again, we're returning to this recurring theme of how, if anything, there's a sort of lack of curiosity in the disinformation journalism paradigm. There's no attempts to understand why these people are sharing this stuff or what's making them unhappy about the world. And in the piece I wrote with that pissed off Aronovitz, that was sort of my main point, that Aronovitz is very happy to sit on Twitter and join the dots between all these different mad people who believe all these different mad things, from vaccines to World Economic Forum conspiracies. There seems to be curious, almost disingenuous sort of attempts to sort of grapple with the reasons why this is, which to me is a far bigger story, which would interest his readers much more. I mean, ultimately, nut hunting, conspiracy theory hunting is actually really boring. I think conspiracy theorists are probably the most boring people on the planet. You know, they're really quite tedious. But, you know, looking at how we've ended up in a situation in which people like Neil Oliver can go on GB News and spout very highly suspect stuff, totally unfounded. I mean, it really veered into absurdity the other week when he started talking about a shortage of tomatoes and how this was preparation for rationing in the face of global disaster or whatever. Sort of really quite batshit stuff. You know, how have we ended up in a situation where people alienated by our media, our government, and the lack of transparency, particularly, which I highlighted in the piece over some issues during the pandemic, how have we ended up in a situation whereby people are willing to entertain all of that? I mean, we can debunk him and laugh at him and attempts to silence him. But this sentiment is not going to go away. And to be fair, you know, Matthew Sweet, who I talk about in the piece, I mean, he's a bit irritating, but, you know, he's onto something. You know, he's right to call out these people. And to be fair to him, he has alluded to this idea of what we're going to do with these people who have clearly completely been led astray. And to me, the fundamental issue is the failure of government and media during the pandemic. That to me is the primary story which we should be focusing on, in which our leading journalists and disinformation reporters should be questioning, rather than sliding to some bloke in Liverpool's DMs who runs a private gym and asking him why he's been sharing videos by Dr. Val Archer. I don't care. Who cares about that? Why not go after Malhotra, which, to be fair, a lot of people have. But for me, the really odd thing about the Andrew Bridgen story was at no point was there any attempt to, as far as I know, I could have got this wrong, but there's no serious attempt to invite him onto something like BBC News or the Today programme and actually put him up against someone who could seriously question his claims that the vaccines were entirely responsible for winter deaths, of which there's absolutely no evidence. You know, if people can, people like Christopher Snowden and John Bai can do it on Twitter, then surely someone at the BBC can as well. You know, it's just, not only are the disinformation reporters doing, you know, focusing on the wrong things, they're not doing a very good job anyway. You know, they're not really living up to their promise.
I remember reading a very interesting paper by a philosopher many, many years ago who was trying to find if it's possible to, in a very epistemologically principled way, devise a means of determining a priori what is an unjustified and what is an unjustified conspiracy theory. Like, is there any way, before looking at the actual facts of the matter, can we say, all right, this is nonsense and this is plausible? And I mean, all of us, we do it in a sense. If someone says there were really no planes on 9/11, we don't say, all right, you know, lay out your theory. But it isn't a very principled way of thinking. I mean, it isn't actually disproving it. It's just a kind of heuristic we have in our heads. And I do think there's a temptation to form these categories of conspiracy theories and everything else, which can become too lazy. So things which could at least have some element of plausibility. Let's say, for example, the vaccines don't do much, if anything, to stop transmission of COVID. It gets bundled into this big category of conspiracy theories before people investigate it. So I really think whenever we have these alternative theories that bubble up out of the swamp of social media, it's important not just to say, you know, no, push it back down, quick. We need to assess the claims that are being made and try to determine if they have any validity, as annoying as that often can be. You've written for us about online disinformation, about online disinformation reporting, but you have also done some original journalism, which I think few writers can claim to have done such bold original journalism. For example, you went to Kharkiv and reported on it for us recently, kind of close to the front lines of the Ukrainian war. You've been talking about this crisis of trust in journalism kind of straying from what we might call the journalistic ideal. What kind of journalistic themes, what kind of stories are you interested in looking into in the future?
Well, you framed my trip to Ukraine. It sounds far more heroic than it was. It was mostly spent sitting in hotels and speaking to people on the phone and hiding from all the horrible things outside. Look, I think there's an awful lot of good journalism, and journalism has always suffered from the problem of the good stuff tends to get overlooked. It's been a huge problem. You know, I spent 6 months after I came out of university working at a documentary company, and I remember one very sad story in which someone had done some great work on exposing relationships in Russian oligarchs, and I think property development companies in London, a very well-researched story, which even seemed to implicate at one point the Russian mafia. And, you know, it got plonked online and people forgot about it in a week. You know, this is a perennial problem in journalism. Stuff gets forgotten. What stories do we want to look into? I mean, it's interesting. I'm trying to write about GB News at the moment and its rise and troubles of late. Because I think many people saw GB News as an opportunity. And interestingly, having spoken to a few people who were there at the start, the vision of it was very different to what it is today. It was very much about trying to find some centrist ground, probably leading to the right. It was about trying to tell stories in the regions of England that, you know, people perhaps weren't being told about. It was about trying to tackle issues like immigration, which is a sort of notoriously tricky one for the BBC. But I'm afraid it's failed. I really do. I think it's descended into, well, that's unfair. There are some aspects of it which do well, but it has become, I think, deservedly associated with a poor reputation, in part due to this model of polemical reporting, which has been imported from the US. And I think, ironically, it's profoundly un-British. There's something deeply un-British about, I think, sitting down in front of the television and listening to Neil and Oliver ramble on about globalists. I don't think we should be going down that route whatsoever. I'm going to return to the BBC. I come from a BBC family. My mum and dad met when they were both working at the BBC. I still believe in the BBC. I think it has fundamental problems, particularly in obsessing over trying to reach an audience it doesn't really understand, to my mind, particularly those people who are classed to be poorer, outside of London, younger. And there's this perception that they want to read about drag queens and all this stuff. And I think the BBC should just do what it's always done well, really, which is, you know, back smart people, back good reporters. There are still many very good reporters who work at the BBC. People like Jeremy Bowen is a fantastic foreign correspondent who's in Ukraine. You know, there's some decent people on the political desk and all that stuff. But sadly, they get overshadowed by, I think, a younger generation who aren't doing their job very well. And, you know, I hear stuff. I'm not really irritated. You talk about me doing original journalism. It's mostly me people harassing people who work at organisations and trying to get them to talk to me when they really want me to just go away and leave them alone. But, you know, I think there's a real generational divide at the BBC. I think the new generation coming up are just... I think Poppy Coburn put it very astutely when she said that journalism is poorly paid and high status. So it attracts a high coterie of activist journalists who are more interested in sort of pushing an agenda than actually objectively working out what's going on in the world. One thing I will say, I've rambled a bit, but I think people like Matt Taibbi, Michael Schellenberger, to an extent Barry Weiss, I think they're really interesting people because they are people who have rejected the church of mainstream media in America, and they've really criticized it quite convincingly. And they now Substack, and they have huge Substack opinions. Substack newsletters, huge subscriptions. And this is, you know, decentralized media, you know, at its finest, really. And this sort of, how long it will last, I don't know, but it's very interesting. Taibbi, I think, in particular, was turned off by the schism, I think, happened in journalism around the time of Trump and Brexit, where people were willingly easy to dismiss all this stuff as the product of bad information online. And I think they really did forego trying to interrogate reality properly and trying to look back in America's history and Britain's history and understand how we'd arrived at these really quite fundamental events in our history. And I really do think people like Taibbi and others, and you know, they really were turned off by this obsession with the online space and what people were posting. So the answer, I guess, is to try and move beyond this online paradigm, this obsession with bad information online and misinformation and disinformation, which to my mind has completely failed.
Excellent. Brad Sculthorpe, thank you very much. And if you want to see some good information online with, of course, a healthy dollop of online and disinformation, please visit thecritic.co.uk. Thank you for listening. See you next time.